Well, the one who holds your hand and my hand is the one who gave us his precious word. And so I want to ask you to take your copy of the scriptures and turn to the book of Luke, Luke chapter 18. I want to begin reading in Luke chapter 18 and verse 9. It says, "To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. 'God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get.' But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.'" We were at the TCU football game a couple of weeks ago, and occasionally the cameras would pan the crowd of spectators and catch some unsuspecting spectator doing something silly. And suddenly they would look up and see that that now they were there on the image mag screen for everyone in the stadium to see. And the spectator would suddenly become the focus of attention for all of the crowd gathered in the stadium. And as I watch that, I've often wondered what it would be like if we had a hidden camera here in the sanctuary. And that camera could pan across the crowd and focus in on worshipers as we're going about what we do together on Sunday mornings. And what would it be like if this camera could not only see the outward appearances, whether you're paying attention or dozing off, but what if this camera could also pick up what you're thinking and the attitude of your heart? How scary would that be? Well, Jesus tells a parable, a story about two men who went to church, who went to the temple in Jerusalem to pray. Little did they know that their actions and their attitudes would be captured on the image mag of heaven for all of us to see. Now, I want you to notice something about this parable that Jesus tells. Jesus, as you know, told scores of parables. It was his favorite way of animating the truths that he was teaching at any given time. But on this occasion, you notice it's a little bit different because most of the time, Jesus told parables about something or about someone. But on this instance, you notice in verse 9 that he told this parable to someone. Specifically to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else. So Jesus is getting up in their business here. He's getting very personal with them. It's telling us here that Jesus knows what's going on in our minds. He knows what's going on in our hearts as we go through what we sometimes call prayer or worship. Don't ever think that any aspect of your life can escape the complete knowledge of God. Sometimes we just cannot come to grips with the fact that God knows what we're thinking. If we really believe that God knew what we were thinking, why would we think some of the things that we think? If God could perceive and does perceive our attitudes, how can we hold attitudes knowing that he has that complete knowledge of us? Remember the occasion when the guys brought their paralyzed friend to Jesus to be healed, and the crowd was so dense that they could not get the guy through the crowd. So they cut a hole in the roof, and they lowered the paralyzed man down in front of Jesus. And Jesus, we're told in the Gospel of Mark, saw the faith of these friends and said to the man, "Your sins are forgiven." Now, there were in the house that day some religious leaders, and they had a problem with this. Thinking that they were out of the hearing of Jesus, they said something to the effect, "Wait a minute here. Only God can forgive sins. This is blasphemy." And Mark 2 and verse 8 says that immediately Jesus knew in his spirit that this is what they were thinking in their hearts. And he said to them, "Why are you thinking these things?" You see, Jesus knows exactly what we're thinking. He knows the attitudes of our hearts. He sees the outward actions. He hears the outward words. But he also perfectly perceives what's behind all of that in our thinking and in our attitudes. And those thoughts and those attitudes become the key to our encountering God the way we need to, and the kind of experience that will cause us to go away changed people. It's our thinking and our attitude that he looks at. So Jesus is giving instructions to his followers about how to properly approach God. And we need to understand that he is the one who determines the entrance requirements. He's the one that determines the way of approach. We do not get to decide that. Jesus is the one who has the authority to say, this is the proper way to approach the Father. And that's what he's teaching us here, the proper way to approach God. The first thing I want you to notice, it all starts with a proper outlook in worship and in prayer. A proper outlook. You see in verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. So we're introduced to two guys here. We don't know how many others are in the temple that day to pray, but we know that there are at least two of them. One is a Pharisee, one a tax collector. Let's look at the Pharisee for a moment and try to understand his outlook. The Pharisees were one of three main groups that existed in the Jewish community. The other two groups were the Sadducees and the Essenes. There were other smaller groups, but these were the three main groups. Think of them kind of like political parties, if you will, within the Jewish community. And the Pharisees were the most popular of these parties, these groups in the day of Jesus. You may recall that the Apostle Paul indicates that he is a Pharisee. The name Pharisee meant separated, and tells us that they favored a very strict obedience to the law of Moses. But underneath that strict obedience and that legalism, oftentimes there was a compromise in their morality. In fact, Jesus would confront them on one occasion, and he calls them hypocrites. He says they're like cups that are all nice and clean on the outside, but they're dirty on the inside. He compares them to whitewashed tombs. On the outside, they're nice and pretty, but on the inside, they're filled with death. And so one of the characters in Jesus' story happens to be one of these guys, one of these Pharisees. And notice how he prays in verse 11. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector." Now, the truth of the matter is that according to the standard of outward religiosity and outward morality, this Pharisee was probably being truthful when he said, "I am not like other men." They were scrupulous in their adherence to the law. They were rigorous in keeping the Jewish ritual. They were meticulous in honoring every religious tradition, and they were zealous in furthering their particular viewpoint. It says in verse 12, "I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get." Now, for the Jews, there was really only one fast that they were obligated to keep, and that was on the Day of Atonement. But a Pharisee may well have fasted two or three times every week. And then a Jewish person was required by the law of Moses to tithe on that which he produced or she produced. But the Pharisee would go further than that and pay a tithe on things that they were not required to pay a tithe on. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But what Jesus is pointing at here is the outlook, the attitude in their hearts. And so when So when the Pharisee says, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, he was telling the truth, but he was also betraying a sinful attitude in his own heart. Now let's look at the tax collector for a moment. Now the tax collectors were also Jews, but they were at the other end of the spectrum from the Pharisees. You see, the Romans taxed the citizens of Palestine during the time of the New Testament, and often the Romans would contract with a middleman, a Jewish middleman, and he would have the rights to collect the taxes from the Jews. And so what would happen is that this tax collector, this middleman, would pay the Roman authorities a fee to collect taxes. And so then he would go out and collect the taxes, and then he would add any amount on top of that that he wanted to for his own personal profit. Now, we don't like paying taxes in our day, and they didn't like paying taxes then either, much less to someone as unscrupulous as a tax collector. And so they were despised. You remember one of the famous tax collectors in the Gospels is a guy by the name of Zacchaeus. And Jesus confronts Zacchaeus one day and enters into a relationship with him. And Zacchaeus, having experienced the transforming love of Jesus Christ, vows that he is going to pay back everything that he has stolen. He was a crook, a thief. Now notice how this tax collector prays in Jesus' story, verse 13. The tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Now, I want you to be careful here, because the idea of this story that Jesus is telling is it's not to make the Pharisee into a villain and the crook into a hero. That's not the point of Jesus' story. The point here is not the moral stature or the lack of moral stature of either of these men. The point is their outlook, the outlook with which they approach God. There are people who are rebellious and lost like the tax collectors, and there are people who are religious and lost like the Pharisees, but they're both lost apart from God. And so the difference in outlook is this. The Pharisee was haughty as he came into the presence of God, and the tax collector was humble. And Jesus will teach us that this is the proper outlook as we approach God. I want you to notice next the true object of worship. The true object of worship. You see, Jesus pulls back the curtain here to let us see and to let us hear the prayers and the worship of these two men. And you're going to notice that there is a difference in the focus of each of these men's praying. First, let's look at the approach of the Pharisee in verse 11. Notice how he stands. It says that the Pharisee stood up. You see that in verse 11? Standing up, that was the posture of prominence and the posture of pride. Notice what he says. He mentions the name of God, but it isn't long before he moves off of that and pushes himself into the center of the picture here. It says there in verse 11 that he prays about himself. You see that? He prays about himself. If you have the New American Standard Version of the Bible, it says he prayed to himself. Now, what an indictment about this man's praying and what he says. The next time you pray, would you just think about how much of yourself is in your praying and how much of God is in it? If you look at this man's praying, you notice there that repeatedly uses the word I. I thank you that I am not like other men. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. It's very clear that the focus, the object of his praying, is himself. Something about where he stands, about what he says, but also we see something here about what he sees. He turns his eyes off God, and the eyes then turn to himself. As I said repeatedly, He focuses on himself. I do this and I do that. And then to build himself even further, he begins to look around the temple to find someone to look down on, one of the other worshipers who he might look down on. How can a person in the presence of God look at anything or anyone else? He stands, he says, God, look at me, and then he sees, he looks around and finds someone whom he thinks is inferior to himself to build himself up. Reading this parable, how do you think God feels about our looking down on another worshiper? I'm going to ask that again. Reading this parable, how do you think God feels when we look down on another worshiper? Well, let's look at the tax collector's approach to God. In verse 13, notice how he stands. The text says there in verse 13 that he stood at a distance. Maybe he felt unworthy. Maybe he knew that he needed to pray, but he did not feel that he had the right to come into the presence of God or even to come inside the temple. You know, I've heard people through the years as they drive by our majestic sanctuary here, and I've actually heard people say, you know, I sat out at my car in the parking lot because I did not feel worthy to come into that place. Maybe this was the way the tax collector felt, unworthy to approach God. Notice what he sees. It says that he could not even look up to heaven. There again, I think we see the humility in his heart, the humility in his life, as he cannot even raise his eyes to look at God. Notice what he does. It says there in verse 13 that he beat his breast. This was an ancient way of expressing contrition and grief. He was literally beating himself up for all of the things that he had done and the way that his life had gone. Notice what he says. He says, verse 13, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Actual, more literal rendering of that sentence in the original text, Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner. The sinner. It's as if the tax collector is saying, God, I am the least righteous of anybody in this room. Lord, I am more sinful than anyone else I know. I am the sinner. The word sinner means someone who misses something, like missing the mark, like failing at something. And from a biblical perspective, it means that we fail at living up to the standards of God's holiness and his righteousness. That's what the Bible says in Romans 3:23, that all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. If in your praying and in your worship your eyes are on yourself, then you might have reason to be proud. You know, you can always find someone who is worse than you are, can't you? That's our tendency. One of the ways that we sort of absolve ourselves from guilt is that we start looking around at people who are worse than we are, and we say, God, what about them? But if your eyes are on a holy God, there's no way to escape the reality that he is holy and we are not. So there's a proper outlook for approaching God. There's one true object in approaching God. But next, there is the ultimate outcome in approaching God. Look at verse 14. Jesus wraps it up by saying, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. You see, again, this all goes back to verse 9. This was the motivation of Jesus in using this parable. Notice again, to some who were confident of their own righteousness. Now, anytime we come to a passage like this, reading it as New Testament believers, we must understand that the cross has thrown a shadow over this text. So today, you and I read this passage, we read this story, this parable, through looking through the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And we understand this about it. You see, if I have confidence in my own righteousness, it reveals that I really do not understand what righteousness is. The Bible says that there is none righteous, not even one human being is righteous. How can anyone have confidence in their own righteousness? And in spite of that, people still try to depend upon and establish their own relationship, trying to impress God and get to heaven based upon our own righteousness and our own good works. And I guess I understand that, because if we go at it that way, if we somehow try to retain a sense of our own righteousness, God, there's surely something good in me that should impress you, that should nudge things in my favor when it comes to getting into heaven. And you see, when we look at it that way, what it does is it helps us to retain a bit of self-worth. It helps us to retain some sense of control and some sense of independence that I can do this by myself. It's an atrocious thing for the human spirit to have to admit that we are absolutely helpless without God. Now, Paul described this Jewish problem in this regard, and it's also our problem. Romans 10:3 says, since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own righteousness, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Do you see the difference there between our righteousness and God's righteousness? So if I'm clinging to my own righteousness to make me right with God, then I miss the whole point of the cross. All we need to do is look at the cross of Jesus Christ. All we need to do is listen carefully to the gospel. And it tells us that there is none righteous, not even one. And 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, God made him, Jesus, who knew no sin, to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. That's the proper understanding of righteousness. The only righteousness recognized in heaven is the righteousness of God through Jesus Christ. And that's why Jesus would say of this tax collector, I tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. The tax collector went home forgiven. The Pharisee went home condemned, still covered in his sin. Now, Jesus is not only speaking to those who have confidence in their own righteousness, but also he is rebuking those who look down on everyone else because of that. And the two go hand in hand. To look down on someone else means this. It means that I am judgmental. When I think that I'm better and more important than other people, then that sets me up as a righteous judge, that I can criticize and I can judge their actions and their attitudes and motives because I have perfect insight. It sets me up to be judgmental. But also, when I look down on other people, it sets me up to be selfish. I basically say, I'm the most important person here, and what I need is really the only thing that matters. And when I set myself up as more important and look down upon other people, it causes me to be independent. To look down on someone else means that I'm better than you are and I don't need you. And when I act in this judgmental, selfish, independent way, it shows that I do not understand the righteousness of God. It shows that I do not understand the whole point of the cross. You see, the cross is the great leveler. The cross puts us all on equal footing, on level ground. All of us in need of mercy and forgiveness and the grace of God. And when I am judgmental towards someone else, when I act selfishly or independent of other people, I'm forgetting the fact that God is alone righteous and I am in need of mercy like everyone else. And thank God that when we approach Christ in this way, we receive mercy. The great hymn says, "Mercy there was great, and grace was free. Pardon there was multiplied to me. There my burdened soul found liberty." Where? At Calvary, at the cross. And you see, friends, when I know how merciful God has been to me, how in the world can I look down on anyone else? How in the world can I not show mercy to every other soul that I meet? Friends, if God had not shown mercy on me, I would be toast. I'm cooked. I'm finished. And friends, if every prayer I pray includes in some way that sentiment, "God, have mercy on me, the sinner." If every time I walk into this place to worship, I say, "God, have mercy on me, the worst sinner in this room." And this is the only way that you and I can experience justification and forgiveness, that we need to get right with God and stay right with God. Jesus said in verse 14, "I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." This is what James tells us in James 4:6. God opposes the proud. Friends, I don't know about you, but I do not want to find myself being opposed by God. You don't want to be in that position. God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. James 4:10 says, "Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up." You know, the grace of God is like water. It always seeks the lowest place. If it rained at your house this weekend, the water that fell out of the sky collected in the lowest place in your yard. And the grace and the mercy and the power of God always collects in the lowest place. You want to find God's grace. You want to find God's mercy. You want to find God's power. You don't find it in being confident in your own righteousness and looking down on others. You find it by humbling yourself and crying out to God every day, "Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner. I need you. I need you for everything. I cannot do a thing without your power and without your grace working in my life." And when we lower ourselves, that's where the mercy and the grace and the power of God collects.